We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
That doesn't make any sense.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 129.
On today's show, we talk about new humans, a buried time capsule, and a shaman's snake stick.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to the show, everybody. We have some news articles for you.
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, it's the 4th of July, otherwise known as... Well, I think probably half the population in this country doesn't know what it stands for. This is just the 4th of July, a date that we celebrate.
I mean, maybe a little better than half.
It's like, do all Mexicans know what Cinco de Mayo is, or are they just saying the 5th of May?
Excuse me, do you know what Cinco de Mayo is?
I, of course, know what Cinco de Mayo is. Something about their independence.
It's
but anyway,
not at all that. Let's not go down that road.
Point is, it's Independence Day, and you're listening to Archaeology Show. So there you go. Okay, so we've got three news articles for you, and the first one has been really making the rounds. I actually kind of avoided it at first and writing it down for us because it was everywhere.
Yeah.
But then it was everywhere, and I figured we should talk about it.
Yeah, for sure.
But we took this particular one from Nature, just a write-up. It's not the actual article, although, awesome enough, the article is linked in the top of this, so you can go to the original Nature article from here. But this article is titled, Mysterious Skull Fossils Expand Human Family Tree, But Questions Remain. Anytime you expand the human family tree, questions remain.
You're just making more questions.
Yeah.
You're putting in-betweens in, you know, and then they make spaces. And then as you fill in more places in between in the tree, it's just more questions. So
I know when I was in my undergrad, I was really into paleoanthropology, which is the study of like basically pre-human ancestry. Mm-hmm. Or I guess prehistoric ancestry,
right.
Fossilized human ancestry.
Like pre-human, basically.
But not just, I backtracked on that because humans go back like 200,000 years and they're included in a lot of cases.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but a lot of times when you think paleoanthropology, you think millions of years old. But,
yeah, like Lucy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or Homo erectus, Homo mm-hmm. habilis, all that stuff with the Leakey family. And I just got to say, this title here, it's not outside the norm for this field because I read a lot of books on paleoanthropology, and every book, when you're reading them, if you read one that was written in like the 60s when they found whatever, or the 30s when they mm-hmm. found whatever, each one says, well, we need to totally rewrite the family tree of, you know, human ancestors.
Right.
Like, oh, you don't say.
Yeah. Like so, every time they find something,
yeah.
It basically rewrites everything.
I'm like, stop writing it in pen because you need an eraser.
It's so definitely evolving.
Right.
Our family tree is. So.
So along those lines, we're going to talk about two fossils, and we've had a lot of articles where it's basically a reanalysis of something that was found a long time ago, and
yeah.
People are just looking at it with fresh eyes now. And that's the same case here, but in two very different cases. They both came out at the same time, which I don't know if that was coordinated or what, but there were fossils found in China a long time ago, which we'll talk about, and fossils found in Israel, both dating to around 140,000 to 200,000 years ago. And essentially, they're different enough from Homo sapiens that both of these sets of researchers think they should be new species. So we're going to talk about both of those a little bit separately, and then we'll bring it all back together. Anyway, what this all kind of stems from is this massive, what we're coming to understand is like a mixing of different species of beings related to Homo sapiens,
right,
in some way, shape, or form, or Neanderthals for that matter. And we're finding that all over Europe, Middle East, China, Northern Asia, you know, like the Russia, Kazakhstan area, mm-hmm. even down into Africa, that there were a lot more species variability than we previously assumed. And one of the big ones that was found not too long ago, I mean, I think less than 10 years ago, was the Denisovans.
Right.
And there was actually DNA there too, which was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But they kind of blew the whole thing up, and then we've been finding all kinds of stuff ever since then.
Yeah, it seems like the Neanderthals are kind of like the largest group of these, mm-hmm. not human, but around at the same time as human, you know, people. But there's a lot more of them than we realized, and it makes us have to shift the way we look at the evolution of humans to what is now modern humans. So,
right.
Yeah, it's interesting.
So to talk about, we're going to kind of jump back and forth because that's what the article does here. But the Israeli fossils says they hinted a new species that are direct ancestors, possibly, of Neanderthals. And we're like, kind of like, what are you talking about there? And might have dominated life in the Levant and lived alongside Homo sapiens. Because, again, Homo sapiens, up to 200,000 years, kind of all over the place. Neanderthals weren't thought to come to this area until about 70,000 years ago. So seeing something that could have been related to Neanderthals 140,000 years ago, not unlikely. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, if they're related. But Neanderthals have always kind of been a European thing. And it's like, did they move from here to there? Did they mate with Neanderthals? Did they, you know, what was going on?
That's not a huge jump, really, to Israel. Yeah. So, like, I could see that happening.
These people weren't exactly explorers, though.
Yeah. And again, you have to remember, too, with fossils from 140,000 years ago, you're not finding a whole lot of them. So just because we haven't found them in a certain area doesn't mean they weren't there. It just means that we haven't found evidence of it yet.
Right.
So this could just be the first evidence of Neanderthals or a precursor to Neanderthals in Israel.
Yeah, could be. And possibly China, which we'll get to.
Yeah, yeah.
A little bit about human evolution. Since about the year 2000, the view of human evolution over the past 500,000 years has become, as they say, complicated.
Mm-hmm.
New genuses I don't know,
I don't know.
Of Homo have been added. In Indonesia, you may have heard of H. floresiensis, hobbits, mm-hmm. although I learned a long time ago and I love saying it, floresiensis.
Well, I was in college when that one came out. Yeah. So like it will always be in my brain because
right.
we learned about it as breaking science.
I know. And they called them hobbits because
yes, yeah.
they were found on an island in a cave, I want to say, and they were definitely human-like, but shorter, way shorter. And it wasn't a bunch of children either.
Right. And also Lord of the Rings was like at its height at that time. True. I believe, or like it was just coming out or something. So,
right.
yes.
And then the Denisovans were found in Siberia. Mm-hmm. And again, there was a little bit of DNA associated with those remains, which was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
I think they got them out of teeth because those preserve DNA well.
I think so. Yeah. Yeah.
And then in South Africa, Homo naledi was found a little while later. And then the Filipino, which I hadn't even heard of, H. luzonensis.
Yeah, that one was new, like 2 years ago new, right?
Right, I think so. Mm-hmm. They don't really keep up on that too much. So.
Yeah.
And all of these overlap with modern humans.
Yeah.
So you've got people running around all over the place going, who's that guy? He looks weird.
Mm-hmm.
So Neanderthals were either outcompeted by or subsumed into modern humans by about 40,000 years ago. So Neanderthals were really prominent for, you know, 30, 40,000 years.
Right.
And a little more going back into Europe. And then eventually just kind of died out around 40,000 years ago. Again, didn't really die out because we definitely have Neanderthal DNA in some modern human populations.
Yep.
But they were gone as a separate species, that's for sure.
Yeah, they intermingled with the population of humans mm-hmm. enough, modern humans, to leave traces of DNA. But
right.
Yeah.
And some of these fossils that have been found in previous years that are just sitting in museum or collections didn't fit neatly into the human family tree. And sometimes that's because it's just really small fragments and you can't really tell.
Yeah.
And you're like, am I looking at something different here or am I looking at a brand new species?
Right.
And it's hard to say without more information, I guess, and without artifacts and things like that. So that being said, people did come along and restudy these things. And again, the Israeli one was dated 140,000 to 200,000 years ago. And the only thing it consists of is some parietal bone parts, which were like the top sides of your skull, and a jaw, a fragment of a jaw.
Mm.
It's actually quite a bit of the jaw if you look at the pictures in the article, likely belonging to the same individual. I wonder if that's because, they can't really refit it, but I wonder if they can tell that from like ages of the bones
mm-hmm.
as they look at it, but also
proximity.
Just found an association.
Yeah.
And then the jaw and teeth were Neanderthal-like. And Neanderthals, again, aren't supposed to be in this area for another 70,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the skull shape was more archaic. And when they say archaic, they mean archaic Homo sapien.
Mm-hmm.
So that was strange. You don't usually find that kind of stuff in association with each other.
But that is interesting, though, because they have two pieces that they think are associated, but those two pieces have features of two different types. Yeah. It would make me, as the researcher, like, re-examine why I thought they were from the same individual.
Makes me think of Piltdown Man.
Right? Yeah. Like, not that anybody would do that on purpose.
I mean, they did.
Well, okay. Yes, many people would do that on purpose. But in this case, I don't really know that much mm-hmm. about what's going on here, but it does make me question whether or not they're the same individual. But yeah. Go on.
So these fossils, along with other unclassified fossils, going back almost 400,000 years, these researchers in Israel are saying that they all belong to a new species called the Nesher Ramla people. And the Nesher Ramla people mastered stone tools just like Homo sapiens. They were found in the article, it said they were found where they were found. They had flint-napped tools mm-hmm. that were sourced over 10 miles away. Which that's a common trait of humans now that still do flint napping and that did it a couple hundred years ago, is you would find source material, you would prep it just a little bit, knock off the stuff you know you're not going to need, throw it in your bag, and then you would create whatever tool you need on the fly mm-hmm. because they could whack out a tool from a preform in minutes. Mm-hmm. So, and then, you know, haft it to a spear tip or something like that. And they were pretty adept at this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, the biggest problem I have with this is, anytime you start lumping,
yeah,
you run into problems.
Yeah.
And lumping means taking 400,000 years and lumping everybody into the same thing and saying, this was all the Nesher Ramla people. How was there so yeah. much evolution in a few 100,000 years, but for this amount of time,
yeah,
no evolution?
I know. The exact same red flags jump out at me. And forgive this bad metaphor, but it would be like having 10 blue puzzle pieces that mm-hmm. all look like they go together. But once you get all 10 of those puzzles and put them together, you find out that each one is from a different puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, like, they might look the same, but they're not necessarily from the same. And you don't know until you get a bigger picture and find more pieces to the puzzle.
I'm going to find like an evolutionary scientist and I'm going to take 12 very similar puzzles and just mix them.
And like tell them to separate it.
Yeah, they're not going to get any of the box tops. And I'm going to say, put this together.
Oh, that's just mean.
Yeah.
Although that is their job too in some ways. That's, so
I know. This is a good analogy though. You're not sure they even come from the same the same picture.
That's the problem I have with that. And also because like they're looking at artifacts that have already been discovered, right? So they're going back to skulls, mostly, yeah. I would assume, that have not been identified and trying to lump them all together. And that just seems suspect.
Exactly. All right. So let's talk about the Chinese skull real quick here. So Dragon Man is what they're calling it. And that is actually named from the place where it was found, I guess. There's the Dragon River and it's a province there. So it's all just
and
called
it's like
Dragon Man.
The most awesome name ever.
Yes.
I'll try to be less skeptical of this one.
I know, right?
It's a sweet name.
Homo Longi. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right because it's probably Chinese. Well, uh-huh. It's Latin translated from Chinese. I guess it's Latin for dragon.
Yeah, I think it is.
So
yeah.
Anyway, this one was actually dug up in 1933. It's called the Harbin skull and was well-preserved cranium dating to about 140,000 years ago. And this, I thought was interesting, thought to belong to a 50-year-old male.
Mm-hmm.
We always talk about, I mean, that's not like super old or anything, but it's a lot older than people typically think about mm-hmm. people living to back in that time period.
Yeah.
And the skull was large and thick with big squares, eye sockets, low cheekbones, large teeth, and a wide palate. Mm. And in the article, they mentioned that possibly this could be related to the Israeli fossils.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And at least in species type.
Hmm.
And they were saying, what's going on here? Did a big group, you know, come from this area and expand out and then turn into Neanderthals? Like maybe they thought Neanderthals kind of originated in Europe, but maybe they didn't. And then, you know, then some became Neanderthals in Europe and different species in other areas, which would make sense. It's a big area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of independent divergent evolution going on, I'm sure of it. So
God, it just seems like we need more puzzle pieces though. Like again, back to that same analogy, but like,
yeah,
it's just hard to draw conclusions without more.
And that's part of the thing too here is this other researcher that was contacted just to comment on this said that naming a new species that was removed from its original context has one specimen and no associated artifacts is kind of a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, we need more data. Now I think personally that it's okay to not write this down and build your career on it, but make a hypothesis based on this mm-hmm. and say, you know what? Our hypothesis is this fossil in China and these fossils in Israel are the same species. let's go find more data.
Yeah.
So let's take some other collections that maybe haven't been analyzed or they're unclassified and go through those and say, do these share traits or characteristics with these fossils that we found here?
Mm-hmm.
What do those date to? And let's start building that puzzle.
Yeah.
Because the pieces are scattered all over the world.
Yeah.
So
I have to imagine that this is really, really difficult to do because of the inherent differences between the sexes, geographically different populations. Like, I'm looking at you and me right now, and like, our skulls will present very differently if you're just looking at our skulls.
Yes.
So like, imagine trying to group different hominin skulls together into populations. Like,
I know,
it's just so hard.
You're more Neanderthal like, and I am definitely
look at that brow.
I am more advanced and hairless, so I don't know, it's kind of weird.
I thought the Neanderthals were pretty hairy, actually.
They were, and I'm not, so there you go.
Oh, so you're not a Neanderthal.
Yeah, you're way hairier than I am.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm all Italian, right. Leave me alone.
Taliothal. Anyway,
no.
All right, so that's it for that. We'll wait for more information because I'm sure, as this has come out, that other people are going to be looking through their collections and saying, hey, ours looks kind of the same as yours does. Let's get them together. And, you know, the nice thing about all this stuff is you could see these bones as kind of a time capsule of human history, if you will. Speaking of time capsules,
oh my God.
Let's move over to the Eastern United States.
See, when you set up a transition, you should let me pick it up. You're not supposed to make your own transition.
Don't ruin my segue. All right, so we're going to talk about time capsules next, back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to episode 129 of the Archaeology Show. And as mentioned, we're going to talk about a time capsule that was found and opened in South Carolina. Now, kind of the cool thing about this is they knew it was there.
Yeah.
It's not like they happened upon this time capsule.
Yeah, like they knew it was there and they went looking for it.
Yeah. And that's kind of a cool thing too is, well, first off, it's the John C. Calhoun Monument in Marion Square in Charleston, South Carolina. Now, a little bit about the stellar individual named John C. Calhoun.
Oh.
He was, now, we got to, I mean, in context, everything has to be taken in context, I guess. So, but he considered slavery a, quote, positive good and was controversial. You don't say. He served in the state legislature for South Carolina, then the federal government as a representative in Congress, a senator, secretary of war, vice president, and secretary of state. So this guy had his hands in a lot of little pies. And this article states that his advocacy of states' rights basically set the stage for the Civil War. So super awesome, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely should leave monuments to him up.
Yes. Yes. So he died in 1850. And not long after that, I guess it was probably 7 or 8 years after that, they put up a monument to him in Charleston, South Carolina. And a newspaper article from 1858 indicated where the time capsule would be. But an article from a year later indicated that it was actually placed in a different location. Like the one in the first article said, here's what it's going to be. And the next article said, well, here's where they actually put it.
Right.
And So there was, I'm not really going to get into the history of this monument, but it was moved at some point. Like the time capsule was moved. They knew it was there, pretty well known. They moved it to a different part. And then because of all these little transitions, it took a while to find the monument because they're actually taking this monument down and moving it possibly to Colombia.
Yeah, it sounds like they don't quite know what to do with it right now because it's a statue to a racist. And yeah. Somebody who forwarded racist policies and helped contribute to causing the Civil War. So they don't quite know what to do with it, I think. So,
and this is one year after it was removed. And there was a lot of statues getting removed this time last year in the wake of George Floyd and a number of other civil rights infringements that were happening.
As well, they should be. Like, I totally agree with that. But then it's also like, well, do you destroy the statue once you take it down?
Yeah.
Like, what do you do with it? Well, do you keep it as like a piece of... albeit terrible history that
I mean,
we can
I think it should go
on?
In the museum. In a museum, because, and I'm not just paraphrasing Indiana Jones here, because we were in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City just like a month and a half ago, a couple months ago. And there's a lot of stuff in there dating back centuries that probably represented some pretty terrible things.
I mean, that's true.
Remember the Japanese statue exhibit? There were people in there that were like warlords and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, these are just. These are now examples that help A, remind us of our past so we don't repeat those mistakes, and B, well, they're also examples of craftsmanship of the time. You know, so the artist who put that statue together shouldn't be, I guess, penalized for having created something, you know, with their art just because that thing is now racist.
I only agree to an extent, like, if it were a shining example of statuary from the time and it just happens to be of a really, really shitty person, like, all right, fine. I guess we can, like, you know, scroll that away in some museum somewhere. And maybe in 100 years or 200 years or at some point when the hurt is not so great still, then it can come back out.
Like if Picasso had painted Hitler, would we want that?
Yeah, I'm not sure the hurt will ever be enough, you know, like, so it just depends on who it is and what they did and how bad it was and how forgiving the society you live in is and the people. So there's a lot of things to consider there.
Yeah.
But that's kind of getting off into a totally different
topic. Yeah.
Back to the time capsule.
let's
look at the fun part of this.
And, I know.
Yeah.
So this is a huge monument. It had a cornerstone and that's where everything was found. And once they found the cornerstone, inside was a rusted cannonball, and it was we have a historical record. Like the newspaper article said exactly what was in here, so we knew what to expect for the most part. But it was found near Fort Moultrie. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, and almost certainly shot by the British during the 1776 Battle of Sullivan's Island, which is interesting. I don't know if it was found later and just passed down to people and like maybe it was Calhoun's favorite thing or something. I don't know. But
well, I think with time capsules, people sometimes take the opportunity to just like put significant things in there. So maybe like Charleston, the city, owned it for whatever reason and decided to include it. Who knows?
But it was already, you know, 90 years old. This cannibal. Yeah. So also a long tin canister containing rolled up fabric. And it was likely a banner raised by sailors during Calhoun's funeral in 1850. A small tin cylinder containing reportedly a lock of Calhoun's thick silvery hair, which is gross.
Okay.
Yeah. Although very prescient, maybe thought they could clone him. I don't know. So, and then a rectangular lead box. So all of these were housed at Brockington and Associates, which is a CRM firm in Charleston. So that's a pretty cool find and job for a CRM firm to have. And it's more than likely because they probably had the only and best lab in the area.
Probably.
In the city to be able to do that. Brockington's a pretty well-known and big CRM firm in the Southeast. They do a lot of good work down there. So the compartment, there was evidence when they opened it that the compartment was once partially filled with water and the cannonball and the containers were incredibly rusted. They were able to shine up the cannonball a little bit, knocking off all the rust, but the containers were super rusted. The tin can that contained the banner, they said that the banner and the can had basically like fused together and it's unlikely and it's unlikely they'll ever get that banner unrolled.
Yeah.
And the hair was pretty much gone.
Yeah.
So the lead box, however, was well sealed and didn't look like water had gotten in.
Yeah.
Like it was basically just completely
sealed up. That totally makes sense. Just slight tangent here because I worked on a cemetery in New Jersey and we uncovered some lead coffins that like looked we didn't open them in the field. They were fully sealed and like unclear what they might have found when they opened it. It could have been a very well preserved body inside of there. So yes, lead boxes can seal and protect things very, very well.
Well, it's like an early form of welding.
Yeah.
Because it's very strong. It's incredibly heavy, but it's very strong. And all you had to do was, I mean, you could put a lead bead on it, which they could do pretty easily, but probably you could just heat it up and melt it together. Yeah. I don't really know.
Yeah. So
anyway, it took them 3 days to carefully remove the lid off this lead box, which is just painstaking. And they also, I didn't write this down in our notes, but they also like opened it with other people in the room, which I got to say, if you're sitting in that lab and that lid's about to pry free, I'm like,
don't want to break that.
But inside, and this would be a super cool find for an archaeologist, was a pristine glass jar, perfectly sealed and filled with scrolls of paper in excellent condition.
So cool.
I couldn't imagine even finding something like that.
Yeah.
The jar was protected with newspapers, so they clearly thought it might be jostled or I don't know what, but they put newspapers in around it. And the in the bottom was a always advertising was a business card of J.F. Church, a plumber. And they said maybe, you know, being a plumber, working with a lot of lead pipes back in the day.
Yeah.
Possibly he's the one that made the box.
Made the box.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's like, yeah, I'll make your box. But just in case.
Here's this my card.
Just in case I'm still around. I'm going to put this down there.
Love it.
Anyway, they haven't opened the jar yet. I don't know what they're waiting on, but historical reports say it contains, and again, this is pretty well documented, it contains a copy of Calhoun's last Senate speech, some continental money. They can see the money through the jar. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
A list of all U.S. and South Carolina governments, which is weird, and a list of members of the Calhoun Monument Ladies Association. There's always a ladies association.
Ladies getting stuff done.
Yeah.
It's what we do.
I know.
Or what they did back in the day.
Right.
Because they couldn't have jobs.
Exactly. So there's apparently a lot more stuff in the jar. There's a lot of scrolls in there that weren't listed in the articles. The article just listed some of the more, I don't know, well-known things that the article thought to mention back in the day. And when they open the jar, they'll probably find out.
Yeah. So. And the jar itself is actually really interesting, too, because it's a, you know, hand-blown jar. And it appears to be like super high quality hand blown glass. So that's really neat. And it's sealed too. The jar itself is, that's why they can't get into it, is because it's sealed with plaster of Paris, which survived, which just speaks to how well the preservation of this lead box was. Very neat.
So we're linking to the article from Live Science, but for some reason there's no pictures, which is unfortunate.
I know. I really want to see what this jar looks like. You know, I love historic glass, so.
I know. It'd be pretty cool. Like, what, so,
is it clear? It must be clear.
So go there for some more detail, but don't go there expecting to see pictures. Sorry about that. All right. Well, we are going to move from there back over to my ancestral homelands, Finland. At least on one side of my family. Uh-huh. And we're going to talk about ritual.
Yay, ritual.
You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to episode 129 of the Archaeology Show, and we're going to talk about ritual.
Yes, more ritual than you can shake a stick at.
Rachel can hardly contain herself right now.
Shaman stick. Oh, yeah.
All right.
I made that joke in the break there, and I had to bring it into the episode, and now my husband is looking at me like I'm a crazy person. So, all right, here we go.
Well, I'm going to start finding more articles about Finland or things that are found in Finland, because I've really wanted to go there for a long time. I've been to Norway, spent a couple days there, actually over the summer solstice in 2005, I think. Mm-hmm. 2004. And it was just such a super cool place. Now, Finland is not Norway, but it's, you know, not very far away. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother's maiden name is actually Finnish. And she was born in the United States, but her parents were born in Norway, or were born in Finland. Mm-hmm. And so my Finnish ancestry doesn't really go back that far to where it's like straight up in Finland. Mm-hmm. And I don't really care too much about ancestry. It's like family stuff was never really that big to my family.
But it's
at
fun,
least
though.
My immediate family. But that being said, I think Finland is a super cool place. I want to go there. I'm trying to get Rachel to go in like January because I love winter. you know, we're going to snowshoe on some like wooden snowshoes and come back and have hot cocoa.
Man.
So
not going to happen.
I know. There you go. So anyway, this article is again from Live Science. They got some good stuff lately. And it's what was found was a 4,400 year old stick carved like a snake discovered in a lake in southwest Finland.
Yeah. So cool.
Yeah.
You got to go look at the article because they've got a picture of it in there and it's very obviously a snake. It's really cool looking.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. And the report said it may have been used for, right at the top of the article, it may have been used for mystical purposes by a shaman. And,
of course.
You know, I said that in my notes here, I shouted ritual to myself and said, should we start a drinking game?
Oh my God. Every time an article is about ritual, totally.
Because over at the Archaeotech podcast, every time we say drone,
yeah,
it's a drinking game.
Yeah.
You gotta take a drink.
Okay.
So,
yeah. I think this might be the same situation for us because it does feel like we talk about ritual like
I know.
Probably way more than we should because like,
yeah.
I think there's a lot more. We assume there's a lot more ritual going on with things that we don't understand.
And don't think you got to take a drink of alcohol. I'm going to take a sip of my coffee right now because we said ritual 16 times.
Perfect. Do it.
Okay, so the stick is about 21 inches long, about an inch thick, carved from a single piece of wood. No word on what kind of wood it was, which I thought would have been interesting. But
they're going to do testing, I think, to find out, because that will be, you know, something that can help them narrow down, like, at least where it came from.
Is it local? Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
who knows,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So the researchers that originally wrote this thought it resembled a grass snake or a European adder in the act of slithering or swimming away because it's kind of got a little bit of a slither to it. Mm-hmm. Not really. It's still like long like a stick would be. So it's more long than it is, I guess, a serpentine.
Yeah.
But
it's got a wave, like a wave
a
to it.
Bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
And another researcher actually that's at, I think she's over in a university in Norway, said that she thinks it looks more like a viper, which she's probably saying that because she studies and is interested in much later in that area, historical folk religion and magic. And vipers apparently play an important role in that history. Now, this is much, much later than now, but maybe this is where the roots started.
I don't know. Sounds like reaching to me.
Yeah.
Like if you look at this, like it looks like a snake, but I don't understand how anybody thinks that they could assign a species to it based on.
Well, the head.
Snake
heads are very diagnostic.
They are, but this is a piece of wood that has been preserved underground. Yeah. It's like worn down. It's very smooth around the edges. Like it looks to me like assigning a species to it would be reaching a little bit and somebody wanting it to be something more than having evidence for it.
It could be our bias, though, because if I was asked to carve a snake out of wood, assuming I had any carving ability whatsoever, like I don't even know what I would do with the head. It would probably be a straight head. Like, I'm not sure what is in my brain as a snake head.
Yeah.
But if this was carved by somebody who either was a shaman or, you know, some sort of ritualistic person or somebody that just lived there, they would have been very aware of the snakes in their area.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have a very clear picture of which snakes are good, which snakes are bad. And you can tell because snake bodies, aside from the patterning on the body, which can give you an indication of its dangerous nature, is one thing. But also the head, like I said, is very
diagnostic.
Yeah,
like the diamond shape can usually mean something that
has
venomous. Yeah.
Yeah. The straight headed ones are more, I think, less venomous typically.
Yeah.
But not all the time.
Not all the time. Not all the time.
Yeah, there's definitely, like the 10 deadliest snakes are in Australia, and I think most of them are like thin, narrow heads.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
The thing that would be interesting to me to know about, and they did touch on this briefly, is whether it was just decorative or maybe just a grave good, you know, but it wasn't meant to be actually used versus was it actually used? Because you have to think about something that is used by a person. There's got to be some function going on there too.
Yeah.
And the snake head could have ended up a little bit more diamond shaped because it gave something for a person to hold on to if they're using it as an actual staff or a cane.
Yeah. They say staff, but you can see where the end of it tapers off at the tail. And I'm like, so was that fixed into something else? Because a 21 inch long staff is for a pretty short little person. Was this Homo floresiensis visiting Finland for the winter?
Well, hold on though, because like I'm 5'3", right? So like how?
That's less than 2 feet.
Yeah,
it's below your waist.
I would need a little bit more.
You need a lot more.
Be a little short. But people back then could have been a lot shorter than they are now. So
I don't know about that. I think if it were part of a staff, it would had to have been fixed into something else, or it was originally longer.
Yeah.
And it's just broken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The head part definitely doesn't look like it's broken. It looks like that was how it So the bottom might have had an extra piece on it or something.
Holding onto a snake head as a staff, that's actually pretty cool.
That's pretty badass,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, like, that's pretty neat.
That's cool. Anyway.
So anyway, we make fun of ritual, but it does seem, because of the what we know the religions of the area, it does seem pretty clearly religious. Mm-hmm. According to the article here, snakes, and I'm going to read directly from it, snakes are loaded with symbolic meaning in both Finno-Ugric, and that's a language family, and Sami, or Sami, I think it's Sami cosmology, and the Sami people are actually in northern Finland right now. And shamans were believed to be able to transform into snakes. Hmm. So maybe this just is a shaman. When it dries out, he'll be like, hey guys.
What's up guys?
Put me back in the lake.
Okay. Here's an off the wall theory. Is there any possibility that it's like a toy or something decorative, but not meant to be used in any way?
I think we discount the creation of toys and things to keep children occupied a lot in the archaeological record.
Yeah, totally.
We immediately go to ritual for a 21-inch long staff.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, it must have been a staff or something related to a shaman, or it's just a child's toy.
Yeah.
And they were idiots and threw it in the lake.
It wouldn't be a lot of fun, probably, to play with a piece of glorified wood.
Couldn't you see a Finnish dad in like August going to their kid, and their kid keeps whacking dad in the shins with this wooden snake that he made him, and dad's trying to gather. Mm-hmm. He's hunting and he's gathering.
He is currently gathering.
The kid's just like dad, and hit him with this snake stick. And he just grabs it and chucked it in the lake and goes, winter is coming. We need to hunt and we need to gather. So that's what I think happened.
You know, I can't think of a better hypothesis. I think we go with that one. That's exactly it.
Yes. Anyway, I thought the Sami was interesting. I didn't know who those people were. They live in northern Scandinavia and Russia. And the Finno-Ugric languages are spoken in Scandinavia and Eastern Europe, as we just mentioned. So anyway, all of this dates to well before the Finnish people began keeping written records. So we don't really know a whole lot about what was going on back then. Mm-hmm. And it's mentioned in the article it could have been an offering tossed into the lake for religious reasons, whatever.
Oh, I like your reason a lot better.
I know. I think it's a little more plausible, to be honest. So,
kids were annoying 4,000 years ago, just like they can be annoying today.
Maybe the lady of the lake cast in shimmer and samite held aloft the snake for the next king of Finland.
We've got the country all wrong this whole time.
I will send you something if you can tell me what movie that's from. I don't know what that is, but I probably shouldn't commit. But anyway.
Oh, my God.
The cool thing about this is that they learned something about the area that somehow they didn't know before. Maybe the article's just saying it. And I imagine archaeologists know this, but the soil is very acidic up there. And if this were buried, it wouldn't be around anymore. It would have probably long since decomposed.
Right.
And this was found from what I understand, actually used to be a lake. Obviously, they're not excavating the bottom of a lake. You can do that, but they're not doing that. It's in a wetland.
Right.
So this used to be a lake. It's now a very, very wet, muddy environment, and they're excavating it, presumably for some sort of development, because I'm not sure why else they would be doing it. Mm-hmm. But they said that this is evidence, just further evidence, that you can't just chunk out some wetlands. You gotta look in them because they preserve stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and you don't know where the water levels were 1,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago. You don't know. You just don't know what you might find.
So anyway, that's what we've got this week. And I want to say we have a new producer, Kimmy, on board. So she's going to be bringing us some more articles and possibly getting us some interviews set up. And if you're interested in having an interview with the Archaeology Podcast Network, if you're a researcher out there and you're doing something right now, head over to archpodnet.com/archaeology, and there's a schedule and interview link on the right hand side. Now, the time frames for this is not very favorable to Europeans or anybody else.
Yeah.
Like east of England.
Yeah.
So
just send us an email though. If like you go to schedule and you're like, oh, that's not going to work. That's three in the morning. Just send us an email and we can work something out because, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I've got another calendar link I can send you that basically opens up pretty much any time morning, you know, for the US, which would be nice evening time for European and beyond. So
yeah, we'd love to speak with some of you guys that are doing like really cool research out there though.
I mean, even if you don't think it's cool, like the world will think it's cool because people love archaeology.
Yeah, exactly.
You might be deep in it and think nobody wants to hear about this, but literally everybody does.
Trust me, so, they do.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks everybody. And we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. You can also find us on the Lyceum app, a podcast app just for educational podcasts. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.